that Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia received respectively 9 and 8%. Meloni said on Monday that a future center-right government would not betray the trust of the Italian people.
Questo è il tempo della responsabilità.
This is a time for responsibility. This is a time in which, if you want to be part of history, you must realize that we have responsibility towards millions of people who chose us. We won't betray it, like we never have.
Meloni's flagship policies include defending traditional social values, anti-immigration programs, and the reduction of taxes. Meloni is slated to become the next prime minister, the first woman in Italy who has ever been appointed to that position. The news that a coalition led by Brothers of Italy won a decisive victory in Italy's snap elections has been welcomed by far-right parties from across Europe. The Brothers of Italy has relentlessly advocated for a free Europe, including sovereign countries, and promoted traditional values and essentialist conceptions of gender.
Certainly it won't be an easy task for Meloni to reassure the EU, other international partners and the moderate electorate, and at the same time maintain a strong connection with international populist groups and a more radical electorate. I don't think Meloni will ever find a way to mediate between these issues. That's why I believe her policies won't be too bold.
Among the defeated coalitions in Italy's national elections was the Democratic Party, growingly seen by a large number of Italians as the party of the establishment. Its leader Enrico Letta conceded defeat early on Monday, adding that his party would be the largest opposition force in the next parliament.
It is evident that mistakes were made. I will lead the next party until the next Congress, when a new leader will be determined.
According to the Italian constitution, newly elected members of the parliament must now meet within 20 days. The country's president, Sergio Mattarella, will begin consultations on who should be appointed as the new prime minister with the presidents of the Senate and Chamber of Deputies, the leaders of the main parties, and, at a later stage, with parliamentary groups. Max Civili, Rome.
The British pound takes a pounding yet again, only days after the country's finance minister announced the biggest tax-cutting package in decades, all funded by borrowing at a time of high inflation. They termed it a mini-budget, but it was a mega shift in direction. The Chancellor confirmed the government would implement Prime Minister Liz Truss's leadership campaign pledges to reverse the national insurance rise, cancel the corporation tax rise, and a surprise new tax cut for the highest earners.
Take the additional rate of income tax. At 45%, it is currently higher than the headline top rate in G7 countries like the US and Italy. And it is even higher than social democracies like Norway. But I'm not going to cut the additional rate of tax today, Mr. Speaker. I'm going to abolish it altogether.
Ordinary Britons may not think about exchange rates on a daily basis, but a fall in the pound will affect their day-to-day.
Britain imports nearly half of its foodstuffs, and therefore the pound gets weaker, the cost of that those basic foodstuffs goes up dramatically. And so anything which is coming in will be hitting inflation at a time when you don't want to have that. The only good news part of actually of this would be actually your exports are now better value. The trouble is if the global demand is shrinking, therefore the demand for those exports would also be shrinking.
There are also concerns about a long recession as winter looms with no end in sight to the energy crisis or the war in Ukraine. Online, calls for a general election are gaining traction. And in the Conservative Party itself, rumors about a no-confidence vote in the brand new prime minister.
Some experts say the UK's central bank, the Bank of England, could intervene to halt the pound sliding. Many others are saying the government's decision to borrow its way out of the current situation could end in tears. Saeed Burizup, London.
The crisis hit Lebanon is once again a scene of angry masses. The parliament is back to meet and debate a new budget. Yet protesters see the budget being discussed as elusive.
Instead of putting together a budget which encourages development in agriculture, industrial production and oil fields in Lebanon, they want to impoverish the people and push them to die in the sea as they immigrate illegally. The government which relies on debt is being controlled by a mob, which is the Banks Association and the Central Bank. They should be held accountable for getting billions of dollars out of the country.
Banks reopened partially on Monday following a week-long closure in the wake of a wave of holdups. Depositors stormed at least 7 bank branches in the capital and abroad demanding their trapped savings.
We know these banks, you know, where we invested our money. But unfortunately, they stole the money between themselves, and they plan, and every time they create a story.
One woman named Saleh Hafiz forced one branch to give her $13,000 of her savings, saying she needed it to pay for her sister's medical treatment. But she didn't take back her money on her own.
They left us no other choice. We encouraged Saleh, and we were with her when she held up the bank, because it was a humanitarian situation, and we will be with all the people who urgently need their money. Our government is rotten and corrupt, and so is the judicial system.
The government has been procrastinating while time is running out. The governmental institutions, including schools, are almost out of service.
The entire governmental sector is paralyzed. The workers, the military personnel, the ministerial workers, the public teachers, they all have rights and they can barely do their job. There's no health care, no educational assistance. The budget plan the parliament is debating today is unfair.
Lebanon's economic downfall began in October 2019. The Lebanese pound has lost around 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar, but officials have failed to put in place necessary reforms. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Over 50 million Italians have been called to cast their ballot in what could be a pivotal election as Italy and a number of EU countries reel from repercussions of the conflict in Ukraine. The cost of energy has increased by 80% on average across the country compared to a year ago, while at the current rate, inflation is expected to reach 15% in 2023. With a growing number of Italians saying they've lost trust in politics, a high level of abstention from voting, much higher than the record low of 73% in the 2018 general elections, has been predicted.
I don't favor any of the candidates. I see little individual seriousness. As a matter of fact, I didn't want to vote at all. I only came to the polls out of my civic sense.
The electoral law must be changed. Those who deserve to rule are not rewarded. I have great distrust of the electoral system and of Italy's politics.
According to the current electoral law, which has already been reviewed twice by the Constitutional Court, citizens cannot pick their favorite candidates on the ballot. They can only vote for blocked lists. It's the parties themselves who will decide which candidates get the votes.
Last time a government was chosen by voters was 13 years ago when Berlusconi won the elections. All the elected governments that have followed have been overturned and replaced with executives of the establishment.
According to pollsters, a right-wing coalition is on course to win a comfortable majority of seats in both houses of the parliament, with the far-right Brothers of Italy party likely to win about 25% of the vote. The Democratic Party comes second with around 22% of preferences. Brothers of Italy party leader, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni, is predicted to become Italy's first ever female prime minister, heading a coalition that features anti-immigration populist Matteo Salvini and 85-year-old media tycoon Silvio Berlusconi. Meloni's flagship policies include defending traditional social values, anti-immigration programs, and the reduction of taxes. She has been supporting sanctions against Moscow so far, while Salvini and Berlusconi have recently said they should be reconsidered. Political analysts believe it could take weeks before a government is installed in the country. Some even say Italians will likely only see a new executive in November. However, if everything goes as expected, Giorgia Meloni stands as the next prime minister. Max Civili, Rome.
The Israeli military has announced a series of closures on the Palestinian territories that will be imposed during a number of Jewish holidays. The first lockdown is imposed for the new Jewish year called Rosh Hashanah and will last till Tuesday midnight. During the closure, all checkpoints between the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and Israel will remain closed. This means Palestinians who have Israeli-issued permits are not allowed to enter Al-Quds and lands occupied in 1948. The Israeli army routinely seals off the West Bank on Jewish holidays, but the closure for the Palestinians is yet another form of the collective punishment that Palestinians have to bitterly endure because of the Israeli occupation.
Closure of the Palestinian territories, including the West Bank cities and refugee camps, comes as part of the collective punishment imposed by the Israeli regime under the pretext of celebrating the new Jewish year. It also imposes more rules on the Palestinians. This measure is part of a widespread war that's meant to strengthen the occupation.
This year, the closure comes at a sensitive time due to rising armed confrontations between Israeli forces and Palestinians in the West Bank. Early on Sunday, another Palestinian was killed during Israeli military raid on Nablus. The Israeli military claimed its troops identified a group of armed Palestinians driving near Nablus. Regime troops opened fire at them, killing Saad Al-Kuni and took his body. Three more Palestinians were wounded during the operation.
The Israeli troops claim the operation came under the routine raids, but what's happening is a barbaric act. They are murdering more Palestinians in cold blood. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank alone. It's clear there is a green light from the Israeli regime and its army to kill more youths under the pretext of confronting resistance fighters.
Meanwhile, scores of Jewish settlers escorted by police broke into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds and performed rituals in its compound. The Israeli military has already increased its military presence across the occupied Palestinian territories even before the start of Jewish holidays. This comes amid the regime's atrocities and military operations to prevent Palestinians' resistance. Mona Khandil, occupied Ramallah.
Rome's suburban Tiburtino Terzo Quarter is once again home to a new edition of the Palestine Festival, a four-day initiative organized by the Palestinian Association of Rome and Lazio Region and the Palestinian Youth Association, created by Palestinian expat Youssef Salman with the aim to foster intercultural understanding and promoting Palestinian culture in the Italian capital. This year's edition of the festival also has a focus on Palestine and Latin America.
Many Latin American countries have been supporting the Palestinian cause. That's what I told to the people who attended the meeting this evening. I also told them about our President Abbas being in New York to discuss a two-state solution. But when will Israel sit at the negotiation table?
A number of Latin American heads of state came out and spoke loudly, proclaiming the rights of the Palestinians and denouncing the Israeli persecution against them at the UN over the past days. At Rome's Palestine Festival, diplomats from the Bolivian, Cuban, and Venezuelan embassies reiterated their support for the cause of Palestinian people in order to restore their legitimate rights. A commemoration of Shirin Abu Akleh was held during a panel on the dreadful living conditions of Palestinian journalists in the occupied territories. Recently, a new forensic analysis proved that the Israeli sniper who killed her could see that Shirin was a journalist before firing the bullet.
In the West Bank, journalists are shot, wounded, or arrested. In the Gaza Strip, there is no internet, no power. We cannot work. Israel simply doesn't want us to do our job. 55 Palestinian journalists have been killed by the Israeli forces in about 20 years. In regards to Shirin, Israeli soldiers knew full well she was a journalist when they killed her. It was a warning sent to all of us journalists in Palestine.
The Palestine Festival will continue on Saturday with an initiative commemorating the Sabra and Shatila massacre and a conference on Italy's and the EU's political stance on the plight of the Palestinians. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
This one lay. This one lay. This one lay.
Bring us on from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Tensions are ratcheting up between Turkey and Greece once again over two Asian islands near the Turkish coast. But a quick history check shows that Greece and Turkey, which are both part of NATO, have feuded for years over maritime borders and energy exploration rights in the Aegean and East Mediterranean seas. In this edition of the program, we will look at whether this crisis between the two can escalate into a possible military confrontation or not, and how this will affect the Eastern Mediterranean region as a whole. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Historian, political analyst, and author Marcus Papadopoulos joins us from London. Also joining us, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at Istanbul Bilgi University, İlter Turan, joins us from Istanbul.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. So let me first start with you, Marcus Papadopoulos, and taking a look at this crisis at the present time that has the two heating up again against each other. Greece deploying U.S. armored vehicles on these two islands, and the ships are loaded with what is said to be U.S. armored vehicles. First question that comes up is, why is Greece deploying these vehicles onto the two islands?
Well, let it be said that the terrible level of tension which exists between Turkey and Greece, coupled with the pure hatred in existence between the two countries, is a profound demonstration of NATO disunity. It is also a profound demonstration of why, when NATO leaders claim that the Western military bloc is unified, they are lying, because NATO is full of divisions. There is great tension between Turkey and Bulgaria. There is tension between Hungary and Romania. And there is tension between Bulgaria and North Macedonia. But turn into the crisis in the Aegean Sea. Erdogan, like his predecessors, is threatening the independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of Greece. Greece is a member of the United Nations, and its borders are internationally recognized. Secondly, Erdogan, again like his predecessors, is pursuing a greater Turkey, like how a greater Albania is being pursued in the Balkans. And thirdly, Erdogan, in threatening the status quo in the Aegean Sea, is effectively undermining the Treaty of Lausanne of 1923, because the Treaty of Lausanne underpins the status quo in the Aegean Sea.
Sure. Do you agree with our guest there, İlter Turan?
I don't know where to start from, but let me say that this
this unity of NATO, which the gentleman has referred to, is of course true, but then NATO was established for a specific purpose, which did not preclude disagreement among its members. In fact, we had some actual fighting as NATO was an anti-Soviet bloc treaty. We had fighting among allies, namely, this is always the case. In fact, as the reason why NATO was formed declines in importance, there is a greater tendency among its members to fall into disagreements. Now, I was fascinated by the gentleman's giving examples of how there are differences between allies, and he referred to a disagreement between Bulgaria and Turkey. I'm not aware of it, but I'm aware of a number of bad relations Greece has with its neighbors, but I will not go into that. I think the question of having weapons on these islands puts the argument that national sovereignty is about international law. And about
well, let me jump in and quickly, if you don't mind. No, I just want to ask you, before you continue, I want to ask you, is what has happened legal or not?
It is illegal. There's no question about that. I mean, you know, according to the treaties of both Lausanne and Paris, Greece is not permitted to arm these islands. Now, the reason Greece is presumably arming these islands is because it is its sovereign right. If we buy that argument, then international agreements have no meaning. And also, let me make one final observation. The gentleman suggested that a number of countries in the region were expansionist. There is really one truly expansionist country in the region, and that is Greece itself. Just look at the map of Greece after wars and what has happened, and it has constantly kept expanding. You look at Turkey after it was founded as a republic, and there is no expansion with the exception of a couple of international agreements. So if there is an expansionary power to be identified in the region, everybody knows who that is.
Marcus Papadopoulos, so is Greece expansionary or Turkey?
What you have just heard from the guest in Istanbul is an inversion of the truth. It is absolutely preposterous to claim that Greece is an expansionist country. Let us look at the facts. Turkey illegally occupies a part of the Republic of Cyprus. Turkey illegally occupies a part of Syria. Turkey, at its will, supported by both America and Britain, invades northern Iraq when it chooses to. Furthermore, it is not Greece which is calling into question Turkey's territorial integrity in accordance with the Treaty of Lausanne. It is Turkey which is doing so. So, quite frankly, the guest in Istanbul does not have a legal or political leg to stand on. And we have to address the reasons as to why Greece is why Greece has deployed military hardware to the islands in question, because Erdogan is making territorial claims against them. The Treaty of Lausanne stipulates that Greece must not establish naval bases on those islands, and Athens has not done so.
Very well. But so that's a point that we need our guests to address, because that is what the agreement specified, isn't it? That you basically are banned from building naval bases or fortifications on these islands, in this particular case, Lesbos and Samos. Isn't that true, İlter Turan?
Apparently, the gentleman is very selective about the reading of the treaty. Actually, Greece is allowed to have law enforcement forces on the island, but nothing else, no military figures. So, but then, let me turn back to some of the allegations the gentleman is felt fully free to volunteer. Of course, it may have escaped the gentleman's attention that the Turkish presence in Syria and in Iraq is not one of claiming that this is Turkish territory. It's not incorporating that, but it is according to the Adana Accords that Turkish forces are in Syria. And it is, again, according to agreements with the Iraqi government in 1998 that the Turkish forces are in northern Iraq. And the moment the particular reason why they're there is gone, Turkey has no claims on the territory of these countries. So I think this is imaginary. Cyprus, I guess the gentleman has forgotten that the conditions under which Turkey intervened on Cyprus. First of all, it's not Greece, incidentally. Let's make that clear. It's not Greece, but it was a military takeover engineered by the Greek government that was that essentially warranted mm-hmm. Turkish intervention on the island. And Turks were being literally ethnically cleansed, so that this intervention was okay. to stop ethnic cleansing.
I think our guest wants to say something in reaction to your statements. Go ahead, Marcus.
Indeed. Turkey is a guarantor, or was a guarantor, of the Republic of Cyprus prior to its invasion of the island in July of 1974. So there were two stages in the Turkish invasion. Attila I effectively put a stop to the coup in Nicosia. That effectively also brought down the military regime in Athens. So therefore, Attila I restored the status quo to the Republic of Cyprus. So why did Turkey then, in August of 1974, launch Attila II, when the status quo had already been restored by Attila I? I put that to the gentleman in Istanbul.
Okay, a quick response, because we've got to move beyond this, because there are other areas of friction and crises between the two that involve a lot of other countries at the same time. Go ahead.
Gentleman has forgotten the fact that Turks were being killed right and left on the island. So that's all I've got to say.
Can you explain Attila
II? All right, let's move on. This is what's interesting here. And Iltar, let me address this to you. Iltar Turan, if I may. You're having Turkey react to what has occurred because you have hardware that was donated by Washington, which is said to be, let me read here, 23 and 18 vehicles, respectively, donated to Athens. Now, I'm looking at 41 vehicles. I don't think anybody in the right mind would just donate 41 vehicles. What is the purpose behind the U.S. donating these vehicles to Greece?
Well, you have to ask that question to the Americans. Apparently, I mean, their ostensible reason is that they are setting up a defense line against Russian expansion, which they find is threatening. And because it is difficult to access the Black Sea through Turkey, because the Montreux Convention does not give foreign warships the liberty of moving in and out of the Black Sea, this sort of Greece, Bulgaria, Romania connection is presumably a way into the Black Sea. But it also appears that the United States is setting up a second line of defense because it doesn't think it can rely on Turkey for NATO purposes sufficiently. And Greece has been made into a depot of U.S. armaments. They're increasing on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And I think because of this changed American position, Greeks have come under the illusion that somehow the United States is ready to defend them. Obviously, great states don't let small states to lead them into conflicts. And it is always important to remember that.
All right, so let's move on here to oil and gas explorations. Marcus, we only have another 12 minutes, even less, but this whole thing is so wide, and the number of countries that are involved are so many when you really dig into this. What are we looking at? We know both Turkey and Greece, they're in a race to develop these energy resources in the Eastern Mediterranean. but they're on separate sides. Where are we going with that, if you can tell us? And what's legal and illegal when it comes to oil explorations in terms of who has the right and who doesn't?
Well, America doesn't favor Greece over Turkey. Indeed, historically, America has favored Turkey over Greece. Why? Because Turkey is of immense geostrategic importance to Washington. And the reason as to why the Americans have supplied the Greek armed forces with these vehicles, which Athens has now deployed to the islands in the Aegean Sea, is because of Erdogan. Firstly, America has
a problematic relationship. Aren't they both NATO members? I mean, if they're NATO members, they shouldn't work off each other. I guess that goes back to your division statement, right?
Yes, absolutely. NATO is not unified. NATO is a very divided military bloc. But this is all aimed at Erdogan. Firstly, America has a problematic relationship with Erdogan, not with the Turkish state, not with the Turkish establishment, but with Erdogan. So the Americans are sending a message to Erdogan by giving the Greek army.
Okay, I got to get a reaction from our guest in Istanbul.
Well, it's about
do you agree, Ilter Tunar? Do you agree with our guest there?
I'm curious about this explanation reduced down to a person who happens to be the president of Turkey at this time. I'm not an admirer of him, mind you, but I have seen no indication that his government has any plans to invade any Greek island. And there is no feeling in Turkey that they want to invade a neighboring country's territory. This is entirely false. And, you know, interestingly enough,
which was put to you.
Let me just say that for the most part, many Turks feel Erdogan was more an American creation. So as to why they are trying to stop him now, if that is the case, would be a very interesting question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we got to dig into this oil and gas exploration because that has been brought up to a point where there have been other countries involved, because I'm going to skip as to the legality or the illegality, but, you know, this involves a number of countries. We're looking at Cyprus. We're looking at France to have gotten involved. We're looking at the possible military aspect to this. Back in 2020 is when there was really a point where you had Rafael jets from France, Marcus, that were flown into that area where there were really heated exchanges. What are we looking at when it comes to that? Because it's not getting resolved, obviously.
The Americans have gathered their allies in the region in what I describe as an Eastern Mediterranean gathering involving Greece, Cyprus, Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, and of course Britain and France, together naturally with America, because there are vast reserves of oil and gas there. And of course, the Americans ultimately want to secure that for themselves. And they will do that by their Eastern Mediterranean gathering. That is another reason as to why I have long contended that American supremacy in West Asia is not on the way out. It is not eroding. If anything, it has been boosted by gathering Washington's friends and allies in the region. But Turkey has not been included. Why? Not because of Turkey per se, but because Erdogan is not playing ball, so to speak, especially when it concerns Russia. Erdogan is intensifying Turkey's economic relationship with America, with Russia. And that is to great annoyance and to great fury of policymakers in Washington. Mm-hmm. So again, that is why the Americans have supplied the Greek armed forces with this weaponry. It's a message to Erdogan, not to Turkey, to Erdogan.
Ilter Tunar, a Turkey publication and media organization that's very well known, has ran this headline where experts believe Greece's increasing violations of Turkish airspace is part of an agenda that's been encouraged by the West to corner Turkey for taking an independent foreign policy. That in particular obviously falls squarely on Erdogan and his stance. Do you agree with that or not?
But actually, I don't agree with that, because when you look at the history of the relations, such allegations have been there all along. The gentleman in London introduced the Russian equation to the discussion, and, you know, Turkish-Russian relations got on the road to improvement ever since the end of the Soviet Union. It's nothing new. So I think this is one thing. Secondly, the argument that this area is blessed with immense amount of natural resources is still something that waits to be proven. In fact, the gentleman's attention may have been away when the United States decided that the idea of building a pipeline, for example, was simply uneconomical. And that is why there are current discussions between Israel and Turkey with regard to whether it would not be possible to connect the Israeli gas to the Turkish pipeline system. So, you know, the critical thing is that this sort of economic zone discussions are political. They need to be political. All the riparian countries need to be incorporated into a discussion. It's not that you could organize some against the others. You have to get them all if you want stability and peace and prosperous exploitation of resources.
Okay. Well, we need to expand more on why you have chosen Erdogan and separated him, Marcus Papadopoulos, from the Turkey equation, because that's very interesting, because you have the way that either coming from Turkey or otherwise, that Erdogan is purely trying to be separated from Turkey, and he's the one that they want to corner. Are they going to be successful in doing that? Because you can't separate, you know, him from Turkey at this point anyways.
The Americans are masters in understanding and having the capabilities to manage difficult relationships. There have been times in the past when American allies and friends have leaders who have been problematic to Washington. But Washington knows that Turkey will always be a staunch friend and ally to America. Turkey will always be in existence, but Erdogan will not always be in existence. That is why the Americans know that their strategic partnership with Turkey is as firm as it has ever been before. There is no tension between the American and Turkish establishments, but for the Americans, they are having problems with Erdogan. Like how there is no tension between the Israeli and Turkish establishments, there is tension between the Israeli establishment and Erdogan.
Thank you very much for that, Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author from London. And İlter Turan from Istanbul, thank you. Emeritus Professor of Political Science at Istanbul Bilgi University. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitahwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Recently, several financial institutions and investment banking companies have warned of a recession looming in Britain as a result of surging inflation and worsening cost of living crisis that has hit Britons hard in recent months. The United Kingdom is facing skyrocketing inflation, which has been unprecedented for decades, prompting thousands of British people in different industries to strike over payments. We have taken a look at some of the world's media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The New York Times writes, raising interest rates to tackle the skyrocketing inflation that has squeezed the life of Britons over the past few months, the Bank of England has said Britain's economy is suffering from recession. A majority of the Bank of England's 9-member Monetary Policy Committee on Thursday, 22nd of September, voted to increase the interest rate by half a percentage point to 2.25%, a record since 2008. The Bank of England said in a statement, should the outlook suggest more persistent inflationary pressures, including from stronger demand, the committee will respond forcefully as necessary. 3 members of the Monetary Policy Committee, MPC, voted for an increase of 0.75%, while 5, including the bank's governor, Andrew Bailey, backed a 0.5 percentage point rise. Under the heavy shadow of surging energy prices and the cost of living crisis, the Bank of England has warned Britain's economy is heading for a second consecutive quarter of falling output, meaning a recession. The Bank of England warned of a second 0.1% drop in the gross domestic product GDP after the economy slumped into reverse, registering a 0.1% drop in GDP in the 3 months to June. The Bank of England said inflation would remain above 10% for a few months after October. According to the Bank of England, the decision came just a day before Chancellor of the Exchequer Kwasi Kwarteng announces the details of the government's energy price guarantee, which would act to prevent a higher peak for inflation. However, the Bank of England warned the impact of the government's guarantee plan risked adding to inflationary pressure. The Bank of England said, while guarantee reduces inflation in the near term, it also means that household spending is likely to be less weak. This would add to inflationary pressures in the medium term. The Financial Times has explained more about the same story. An industry watchdog survey has revealed Britain's economy is showing signs of stalling as high inflation threatens a recession across the country. In its survey findings published recently, the Standard & Poor's Global Purchasing Managers Index, or PMI, showed British firms and factories have been hit by a slowdown in new orders, as the companies raise pay and pass higher costs onto clients. Chris Williamson, chief business economist at Standard & Poor's Global Market Intelligence, said, "The economy is starting to look like it is running on empty," adding, "Business confidence has now slumped to a level which has in the past typically signalled an imminent recession." In addition, UK private sector firms say demand has been hit by purchase hesitancy and squeezed budgets due to high inflation. Meanwhile, Britons are paying higher living costs and fuel prices as national inflation climbs to above 10%, as the highest record in the past 40 years. The Bank of England is worried that the recent jump in inflation might turn into a permanent problem for Britain's economy. According to Standard & Poor's global figures, there are intense staff shortages and pay levels have risen. Recently, the Bank of England drew a gloomy picture for the future, warning that worse is yet to come, as the current inflation is likely to remain above 10% over the coming days, while climbing to 11% in October, when regulated household energy bills are due to soar once again. On Thursday, 20th of September, Britain's pound sterling exchange rate fell by more than 1% against the US dollar to $1.1351, registering its lowest number since 1985. The British pound also hit a 17-month low against the euro, with 1 euro worth about 87 pence. Adding to the economic pressure across the country, the Consumer Prices Index is now standing at 9.9%, the highest level since the early 1980s and almost five times the Bank of England's 2% target rate. The British newspaper The Telegraph has also covered the same story, but from a different angle. Research from housing charity Shelter has shown 1 in 7, or almost 1.1 million people, private renters in England, have been hit by a rent hike in recent weeks. Nearly 13% of people surveyed for the charity between 29th of July and 17th of August said their rent had been increased in the last month. The survey also revealed that 3 in every 10 renters, or 30%, are behind on their rental payments or are constantly struggling to pay their rent. And a third, or 32%, say they're spending at least half of their household income on rent. The figures showed the number of families with children in the United Kingdom assessed as needing help to prevent them from becoming homeless or to relieve their homelessness has risen by almost a quarter in a year. According to the annual data from the Department for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities, some 56,340 households with children needed help to stop them becoming homeless in 2021-2022. This is up from 23.6% from the previous year. Matt Downey, UK Chief Executive of Crisis, said, "At a time when the cost of living crisis is hitting households, it's deeply worrying that people are being forced from their homes, though through no fault of their own, and plunged into instability, unable to afford somewhere to live." He pointed out the figures only cover the first months of the rising cost of living and called for the government to increase housing benefit, properly protect renters from no-fault evictions, and set out a plan for more genuine, affordable homes. In August, the Bank of England forecast a recession for the world's fifth biggest economy, lasting from end of 2022 until early 2024, due in large part to the hit to the living standards from energy prices, pushed up by the sanctions imposed against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine. Soaring energy prices coupled with runaway inflation have imperiled the livelihood of Europeans. European governments are enforcing measures to cut down on gas usage and, as an alternative source of energy, have also started focusing on nuclear power.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.